You see, now you cannot have a child because there is the causes do not relate for you to have a child. Maybe now you have a problem. Maybe the wife has a problem or something. The causes do not come together to cause the effect of having a child. And because of that, you see that the Islamic Ummah is reducing in quantity. So that people that we want to be able to be in the part of the ministry of Imam, they need to be born, they need to be progressed, they need to work on their knowledge, they need to work on their activities. You see, we have a lot of sections. So for example, right now in Islam, we have mujtahid, we have marajas, we have muballighs, we have sukhanran, we have those
the,
who
the
gives,
orators, the
yeah,
presenters.
Orators.
That's right.
But everyone has, even though their roles are different, you will see that all of them require to be together.
Mm-hmm.
All of them require to be together to be able to complete this mission of Islam to the world.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
When we get to the duties of the Muslims regarding Imamah, what are the main duties of the people? Because during Ghaiba, there are some duties on the people. And if Imam reappears, what about the duties of the people on that time?
So we have seen in a lot of contrast that when a person, in regards to the reappearance of the Imam again, as I said, that people do a lot of mistakes that have happened in the history. So if you see that when the Holy Prophet was in this world, it was only after a certain age that he came out to do tabligh of deen, to spread the religion of Islam, to introduce Islam to be the truth. And if you see the Prophet, the moment that he started doing this and narrating Islam or bringing Islam to the people, showing Islam to the people, it was not from his birth.
Mm-hmm.
So that period that he was born, till the period that he started doing tabligh, you could call that small portion as a ghaiba.
Yes.
You see, in a contrast, where we say that he was among the people, but nobody knew him,
mm-hmm.
that he was the prophet of Allah. You see, it's only when the causes and effects for him to be able to propagate safely, properly, without any issues, he need Amirul Mumineen's existence, maybe Khadija's being there, and a lot of things. Because they were there, the Prophet existed with his mission and started to propagate the religion. Another instance why Imam is not coming before we go to the duties of the Muslim is the ghaiba of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. When I say ghaiba, I don't mean the occultation that we are used to, not being there, but not being physically present at that city. So for the people of Kufa, they knew the Imam is there in Medina, in Mecca, and they wrote him letter.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the Imam was ghaib, away from their sight.
Yes.
They wrote him letters. You see, like the way we recite Dua Ahad, we recite the Dua for his reappearance.
Yes.
Though they wrote the similar words for Imam Hussein to come. But the moment Imam Hussein made an intention to come, what did they do? They were the main reasons for him to be killed. So if you bring that to the ghaiba of Imam As, you can see the same progress. A lot of us do dua, but we are not trying to learn from history. We do not know history. A lot of Muslims today, they do not know history and learn from the lessons of history. Where Allah also tells us, the Holy Prophet tells us, learn from the mistakes of the past. Mm-hmm. For you are supposed to be a great nation. Mm-hmm. Like for the zuhur of Imam, if we are not ready, we cannot survive his coming. You see? And that's why we need to learn from those mistakes. What happened in the time of Imam Hussein in Kufa, that people actually became the killers of Imam Hussein. So why? They were scared. So what do you need to be? What is the opposite of being scared? Being brave. Shuja. Are we instilling our kids ourselves? Now this is where we are talking about what should we do. Do we have this instillation of braveness in us and our kids? That tomorrow if zulm happens, then we are ready to stand against zulm. Today, you see the whole Arab world is not speaking, not taking any action against what is happening in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yes.
And this may be one of the reasons that if this is happening, then what will happen with Imam Asr alayhi salam today would be the same fate what happened to Hazrat Muslim ibn Aqil. You see? He would come, he would have a lot of people. Same thing that happened to Prophet Isa alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
You see? He came, he showed the people the right path, but the moment that they were ready, they left him. You see? And that ended up for, according to what was narrated in the Bible, and think that he was crucified. If Jesus was in this world, in Quran we say that Allah brought him up. He didn't accept the Prophet to be oppressed in that manner. He brought Jesus to himself, Isa to himself. You see? But he doesn't want to do the same with Mahdi. He wants to send Mahdi so that the world is filled with justice. And when will that happen? These occurrences that happened in the past has no chance of happening when Imam arrives. So what we need to do, we need to be brave. The brave need to be powerful. The brave need to be taking positions in different countries, in different places, to be able to invite Imam and be ready to work on it so that there is nothing that would drop them away from the path of Imam alayhi salam.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh and Brother Suhail, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of the reappearance of Imam. Asked what are our duties and what are the barriers. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The indiscriminate shelling that has been pounding all areas of Gaza Strip has resulted in paralysis of the health sector and the coastal territory. The already collapsed health sector in Gaza has forced the wounded people to undergo operations in their injured limbs without anesthesia. In the meantime, the suffering of people with dialysis has aggravated incrementally. as the instruments and medical appliances became completely overwhelmed with the doubled number of patients.
The situation is so dire and difficult. We lack all basic medical needs over the continuous Israeli airstrikes. We received thousands of the injured people with difficult injuries and burns. Even the patients of the chronic diseases are suffering. We don't have enough medical staff. We don't have enough beds. Many injured people were treated on the floor without anesthesia. Many injured people had their limbs amputated over the lack of medical necessities.
Another aspect of this prolonged onslaught is unfolding with the intake of contaminated water and malnutrition. Children are suffering from a wide scale of intestinal diseases as a result of having no access to the basic humanitarian necessities.
Gaza's health sector was suffering even before the aggression due to the suffocating siege. However, with this unprecedented aggression, the suffering exacerbated, particularly the need to medicine and cure of the sick people. There is a severe shortage of the needed medical supplies and needs, particularly those needed for the dialysis department. On the other hand, we received many cases of children diagnosed with intestinal diseases because of the contaminated water and malnutrition.
For the people here, it takes standing in long lines in front of the pharmacy, waiting to get the medicine needed for any illness. Often it's unavailable because of the overuse of all kinds of medicine.
My child is 1 year old. He's sick. He was infected with stomach flu and he has chronic convulsions. He was lying in the Nasser hospital in Gaza when the Israeli forces attacked it. I attempted to bring the medicine with me when I came to the middle area, but the Israeli soldiers on the checkpoint ordered me to drop it. For days, I've been trying to get the medicine, but I couldn't. Every time they tell me it's unavailable, I don't know what to do.
As we have just seen, these are some details of the continuous and extended disaster that the Palestinian people are living and experiencing these moments in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital as a place taken shelter by the Palestinian people. It's clear that the people here are trapped between the rock of the continuous airstrikes and the hard place of the deteriorating humanitarian conditions in Gaza Strip. Ja'awun Sabah, the middle area of Gaza Strip.
On Saturday, about 2,000 people joined a protest in solidarity with besieged Palestinians in Sydney's iconic Hyde Park. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide in Gaza, was organized by the Palestine Action Group, a Sydney-based activist formation committed to supporting Palestine and opposing the Israeli apartheid. Pro-Palestine rallies have been held weekly across all major Australian cities over the past 2.5 months. On its Facebook page, the Palestine Action Group presented Saturday's rally in Sydney by saying that Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza continues with the complicity of the world's governments, especially the US and including Australia.
We don't hear enough about the non-stop killings, the atrocities that are happening in Gaza. And meanwhile, mainstream countries like the USA stand by and continue to support Israel, continuing on its line that it's using. I disagree with all of that, and I'm going to find it very hard to ever forgive America for backing Israel and what it's doing, for delaying the ceasefire.
During Saturday's rally in Sydney, which occurred a day earlier than usual, with organizers wanting to maximize numbers ahead of Christmas, protesters chanted slogans against the apartheid Israeli regime in Gaza and in the West Bank, calling for Australia to cut ties with Tel Aviv.
Earlier this week, more than 50 former and current lawmakers from the Labour Party, the ruling force at the national level in Australia, broke ranks calling for a rethink on policy towards Israel. The Australian political figures signed a letter condemning Israel's domination of Palestine and demanding Canberra recognize Palestine as a state.
On Saturday, a rally in support of Palestinians was also organized at Melbourne's State Library. Max Civili, Sydney.
Tehran has hosted the third Iran-Jail International Exhibition. The event is seen as an impressive milestone, being the first and foremost commercial event in Iran dedicated to geomatics and spatial information in the country. Geomedics is not a well-known term among the public, but it's actually the driving force behind many of the daily activities in modern life. The third Iran Geo exhibition offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in that field. Geomedics has its traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, archaeological excavation, climate change and environmental monitoring, disaster risk reduction, and estimation of crop yields. Over the past decade, an increasing number of tech firms in Iran have expressed interest in the field. Organizers say during the 4 days of the third Geomedics exhibition, business-to-business meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. Experts here say the range of the applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investments to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran.
With its magnitude and the support it has received, the Iran Geo exhibition serves as a platform for fostering advancements and collaborations in the field of geometrics and spatial information in Iran. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
Several rallies have taken place in Palestinian camps in Syria in response to a call by Palestinian factions to show their continuous support for Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, which demonstrated the weakness of the Israeli army. Participants affirm that Syria will always be the backbone of the resistance until the liberation of all occupied territories. They also expressed their gratitude to the resistance front and their confidence in the victory of Gaza.
We salute the resistance front, including Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, which humiliated the enemy, and our brave brothers in Iraq and Yemen, who proved to the world that they are committed to the Palestinian cause.
We are here to support and stand by our steadfast people in Gaza, who are defending the dignity of the entire Islamic and Arab nation, because the Palestinian resistance in Gaza is an epitome of pride and glory for us as Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims.
Protesters condemned the Israeli crimes against innocent civilians in Gaza, demanding a stop to the aggression and an end to the unlawful siege. They stressed that the Palestinian cause will remain alive through the generations, and Palestinians will not relinquish the right to the complete liberation of the occupied Palestinian territories.
We are gathered here today to demand the complete liberation of Palestinian lands from the river to the sea. We are the living nation that never dies, no matter how many martyrs we offer for the sake of Palestine. We will return, and the coming generation will liberate Palestine.
We in Syria affirm that we are an inseparable part of the Palestinian people who are being slaughtered and killed before the eyes and ears of the entire world. We believe that Palestine will triumph through resistance over the instruments of the murder and crime, along with those who support them.
People in Al-Spina camp took to the streets in a massive rally carrying the flags of Palestine and Syria, as well as pictures of the martyrs. These demonstrations convey the message of unity and shared destiny, which is expressed through the sacred struggle to liberate Al-Quds. Participants stressed that what is taken by force can only be regained by force.
Syrians and Palestinians came out today to say that Gaza and its resistance are not only defending the Palestinian territories, but also all Arabs and Muslims. They emphasized that the faith of the resistance is much stronger than the war crimes and atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
The most important documentary cinema event in West Asia has once again brought together filmmakers from across the world to Tehran. This time around, with a remarkable surge in the number of participants, which also includes some prominent figures. A true testament that in its 17th edition, the festival is definitely living up to its purpose, becoming a platform for muffled voices and untold stories. From fighting and eventually defeating Daesh terrorists to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. The presence of award-winning American filmmaker John Langley, director of one of the most prominent films documenting the events in Gaza, has taken the festival to the next level, as he shared some valuable experiences in a workshop on the sidelines of the event, bringing attention to the important role documentaries play in shaping public opinion.
It's absolutely shocking. It's a crime against humanity. It's a genocide that's happening. And the world is incapable of overcoming the allies who are keeping this going. You know? So it's absolutely unpardonable. And the world and humanity will have to... It's one more massacre in the long history of atrocities, of human atrocities. But it has a specific aspect to it also. It's happening and it's being shown in real time. So it's a massacre that is being televised in real time. And for it to happen in that way and for the world not be able to stop it, this is really shocking. And in general, I think the festival has really gathered some very good specialists, film workers that are bringing lots of experience, not only in the field of methods and filming, but in how to film in regions that are full of sensitive questions, of issues,
Award-winning Polish director and cinematographer Hanna Polak, who is also a jury member, couldn't agree more.
But there is, I think, more great films than we have awards. So this is going to be very challenging, these decisions. But it is very good to see strong, beautiful films from all over, from different places. Also, some really good Iranian films, some Iranian good documentaries.
All of this means that the experienced filmmakers taking part this year can play a crucial role in shaping a young generation of documentary filmmakers whose presence is also quite significant.
There are more than a dozen awards up for grabs to celebrate the very best of the submissions. But with more than 2,500 entries, the competition is quite fierce. In any case, the festival will be running until December 23rd, at which point we will figure out which of the movies will be winning the awards. Gisum Shahmari, Tehran.
Last Tuesday, the Independent High Electoral Commission announced the preliminary results of Iraq's provincial elections. The commission stated that 41% eligible voters cast their ballots on Monday in a climate of anticipation, integrity, and success.
The Independent High Electoral Commission has fulfilled the constitutional entitlement to hold the provincial elections and perform the national duty it was assigned to do in 2023.
The demand of the people is mainly the public services. Me personally, as a citizen, my only demand is to have the basic services that provincial councils can provide.
Results in most of the provinces showed a major leading for the We Build Alliance, led by Hadi Al-Amri, and State of Law Coalition, led by the former Prime Minister Nouril Maliki. The capital city of Baghdad results showed high competitiveness between three electoral lists. Coming in first is Taqaddum Party, led by the former Parliament Speaker Mohammed Al-Halbousi, collecting more than 132,000 votes, while the We Build Alliance came second with more than 131,000 votes, and the State of Law Coalition in third with more than 130,000 votes. As for the city of Basra, Tasmim Alliance, led by the current Basra governor Asad Al-Aidani, won with over 266,000 votes, while the northern city of Kirkuk recorded the highest turnout across all provinces, with more than 566,000 votes, and witnessed the winning of Patriotic Union of Kurdistan with over 139,000 votes.
The results came out as expected. The well-known political forces collected the most votes, and now all eyes are heading towards the post-election stage, where political blocs from alliances decide who will have the biggest share and who will have the capability to assign the governor for Baghdad and other provinces.
From his part, Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani congratulated the political forces and the winners who have gained the confidence of the public. He also stressed that the government has fulfilled its obligations in holding local elections as a national and constitutional entitlement. He also added that provincial councils are an important step to promote the democratic, decentralized approach adopted in Iraq, which gives local governments the ability for budget management and electing governors, all of which can be a major factor in supporting the current development and reconstruction plan the country is undergoing, and likely to draw a positive effect on supporting future projects that the government has planned for each province.
In a climate of anticipation and success, the Iraqi government has fulfilled its obligation to hold local elections, which is a major step in the path of completing the ongoing reconstruction plan in the provinces. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian traveled to Qatar in his fourth visit since Israel's onslaught on Gaza began over 70 days ago. He met with his Qatari counterpart, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, discussing bilateral ties as well as recent developments in the region.
We talked about the Palestinian issue. We also discussed bilateral relations between Iran and Qatar, including political and economic ties.
During his visit, Amir Abdullahian also met with the leader of Palestine's Hamas resistance movement, Ismail Haniyeh, to discuss a possible ceasefire in Gaza as the Israeli regime continues its genocidal campaign in the besieged strip.
Hamas officials, who are the main party in this story on behalf of the Palestinian nation, believe that reaching any agreement with Israel is not a real thing in the shadow of the continuation of the killing of women and children. And if the U.S. and Israel are serious about an agreement, they can start dialogue after establishing a ceasefire.
For his part, Haniyeh said that despite all the relentless pressure from Israel, the resistance has remained steadfast on the ground and has managed to inflict heavy losses on the occupying regime.
The military aggression of the Zionist regime against the people of Gaza is unprecedented, and we are witnessing a massive amount of attacks from air, sea, and land against the residents of Gaza. The Zionist regime and its allies thought they could destroy the resistance and that the resistance would be forced to raise the white flag. But after 75 days of mass killings and war crimes by the Zionist regime, the resistance is still firm and steady on the ground and has inflicted heavy losses on the Zionist regime.
The Iranian foreign minister has stated that his visit came following recent developments that show the whole region is seeking a stable ceasefire in Gaza.
Experts believe that any end to Israel's genocidal war, which has failed to achieve any of its goals in Gaza, only serves the interests of the Palestinian resistance factions. Reaching a truce, however, won't help the Israeli regime to repair its tarnished image after it lost the international support over the atrocities it committed in the besieged strip. Farzana Shuryun, Doha.
Another phase of the current catastrophe that the displaced Palestinians who are taking shelter in the yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah city are going through is coping with the heavy rain that has hit the Gaza Strip. It just took less than 10 minutes for the tents, which are made of scraps of plastic or fabric, to be flooded completely with water, and for the land to be turned into swamps, obstructing the movement of people. The rainwater has at least half a meter deep and overwhelmed the people inside the tents, soaking all existing clothes and covers, albeit little.
This is my tent. It is made of plastic and has an area of 4 square meters. My family consists of 13 members. We all sleep inside this tent. After it rained, the tent was engulfed by half a meter of rainwater that soaked our clothes and blankets. Thus, we hug each other to warm the children. We will remain steadfast no matter what happened.
It was just a matter of a few seconds for the people here to realize that they are trapped between the hardship of having access to the basic humanitarian needs and the demolicious rainy weather. Civil defense crews, who are totally overwhelmed with attempts to recover bodies from the rubble of houses destroyed by Israeli strikes, rushed to help the people. despite the lack of needed equipment.
The people here are living in tents, which were totally flooded with rainwater, because these tents are not designed or prepared to endure this heavy rain. Despite the lack of the needed equipment, we managed to help the people using some primitive means. However, these tents need to be rehabilitated in order to provide protection against the harsh winter.
It's worth mentioning that at least 4,000 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, have been taking shelter at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital since the Israeli forces launched a ground offensive in the northern part of the Gaza Strip and in Gaza City.
This is another dark side of this continuous suffering for the displaced Palestinians here in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. It is unfolding with the continuous heavy rain. The people here are living inside tents which are not designed or established to protect them from this kind of unprecedented situation. This is a continuation of the distress that the Palestinian people here are experiencing. Muti Abu Msabih, middle area of Gaza Strip.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In a potentially course-altering turn of events, the Zionist regime's much-hyped and celebrated Golani Brigade has just retreated from the besieged Gaza Strip, completely humiliated and functionally inoperable. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, in a potentially course-altering turn of events, the Zionist regime's much-hyped and celebrated Golani Brigade has just retreated from the besieged Gaza Strip, completely humiliated and functionally inoperable. This notorious military brigade has existed since 1948 Nakba and has been instrumental in carrying out some of the occupying regime's most horrific war crimes against Palestinians. Recently, the Hamas-led Palestinian resistance dealt a heavy blow to the brigade that will take years to recover from, the time they do not have. The Zionist regime's military officials claim that the brigade is regrouping, but information has leaked in combination with public announcements, which reveals that it is no tactical regroup. Not only have a significant number of the Zionist regime officers have been eliminated by the resurgent Palestinian resistance fighters, but the scores of troops are also either dead or wounded. The regrouping at this point means the infamous Golani Brigade, which is the pride of the Zionist occupation, has been rendered incapable of carrying aggression within Gaza. The eliminated officers include rankings ranging from sergeant all the way to multiple lieutenants, colonels, and commanders. The significant lack of leadership and destroyed troops, paired with those who have been wounded or suffer mental health, PTSD issues have put the brigade out of commission, at least for the foreseeable future. Within the ranks, morale is at an all-time low, especially considering the fierce fighting still displayed by Palestinian resistance, which has effectively pushed the occupation forces on the back foot. By most modern military standards, being forced into a retreat with no plans for re-entry means losing roughly 30% of a fighting force. It is reported that the Golani Brigades lost anywhere between a quarter and a third of its active force, with significant leadership ranks eliminated with no replacements. It is long known that the Tel Aviv regime hides its true number of casualties. If we can estimate that they lost even a conservative fourth of their Golani force, the number of casualties for the brigade alone could range from 250 to approximately just below 1,000. The beginning of the end was the start of Al-Aqsa Storm operation on October 7th, which took the Zionist regime and its Western backers by complete surprise. The Zionist regime's military general Moshe Kaplinsky revealed that the initial operation led by resistance movement Hamas led to the elimination of 72 occupation troops from the Golani Brigade alone. But as the Golani troops entered Gaza for the first time in 9 years, they were quickly reminded by the Palestinian resistance why they didn't stand a chance the last time. Between failing to defend themselves from Palestinian ambushes and their own incompetence, the brigade found itself sniped, shot at with rockets, and blown to bits by traps, particularly on December 12th, when resistance fighters led by Hamas destroyed several Golani officers within a single ambush. The significance of the December 12 ambush must be meticulously examined. It not only was a tactical victory for Palestinian resistance, but its cascading effects have forced the occupation regime to rethink its strategy completely, likely permanently. It is reported that 4 Zionist troops lost contact with the rest of their company in the Ash-Shujaa neighborhood. When a rescue mission was underway to retrieve them, they were ambushed and several officers were eliminated. Amid the confusion and lack of leadership, several other regime troops were also eliminated. Losses were suffered in both the 51st and 13th battalions based on data released by Zionist media. The Zionist regime's top brass are almost always forced to report the death of major officers to their media. That day, the list was a lot bigger than other days, and questions were raised about the effectiveness of the Zionist troops, especially as Hamas published video after video of successful confrontations, while the Zionist army's staged surrenders and fake evidence were mocked and questioned. Thus, panic ensnared the Israeli occupation forces, and their performance showed it. On December 15th, Israeli regime forces announced that the troops mistakenly killed 3 Israeli captives, thinking they were Palestinians. Zionist media reported the captives were yelling in Hebrew and carrying a white flag. All 3 were shot and killed. These are the markings of a military in catastrophic disarray. Then, even before the regrouping on December 21st, came the actual sign of defeat. 7 days after the ambush, on December 19th, Tel Aviv offered to revive talks for a swap and temporary ceasefire. This decision was framed as out of the blue by many Western media outlets. Some Western media resources even
naively saw this move for an exchange as an act of mercy, which just concedes that it is well known that the Zionist regime is carrying out a textbook genocide. But nothing happens without reason, especially in warfare. As we have examined, the days that followed the ambush likely were met with low troop morale, and even lower performance not just from the Golani Brigade, but from all Zionist forces within Gaza. It is also important to note that within this time frame, Tel Aviv saw more anti-Netanyahu protests. From all fronts, the idea that the occupying regime was winning in Gaza was collapsing. Progress was screeching to a complete halt. The Zionist army needed time and a scramble to negotiate an unfavorable deal. Hamas rejected it, demonstrating that they determined the course of the battle and would begin any exchange process on their own terms, with their offer of all for all. All of the Israelis held by Hamas released for every Palestinian held by Israel. Understanding this order of events and their intention is key to what is happening on the battlefield. If the Zionist regime retreated first and then offered talks to have captives released, this would surely show their Western backers, primarily the United States, that they do not stand a chance. After all, their entire ground invasion has been an awkward maneuver to prove that Hamas are terrorists via fabricated evidence. The entirety of the ground invasion is a feeble attempt to justify their genocidal crimes. But in order to cover up their unsustainable losses, they choose to offer exchange talks again, then frame their retreat as a regroup as an effect of failed talks. This intentionally dilutes the matter. The cause of the retreat is not failed talks or the inability to retrieve captives. The cause of the retreat is the effectiveness of the Hamas-led resistance. The bottom line is that the unified Palestinian resistance forces are dealing blow after blow to a confused and low-morale Israeli regime army. While this is happening, international pressure is mounting on the Zionist regime to stop the indiscriminate Gaza bombings, while Yemen and Hezbollah continue to put the Zionist regime in a chokehold of their own on their respective fronts. Tel Aviv regime has nothing to show for its barbaric slaughter of at least 20,000 Palestinians, most of them children. The Zionist regime asserted weeks ago that this war would last months, but if this current trajectory of warfare is maintained, then Palestinian victory is within reach and a foregone conclusion.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. This is IRIB English Radio and welcome back to your station. I am Bita and here
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm Hassanin. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Assalamu alaikum, my brother. And we're going to talk about a new topic. As you know, from the moment that we wake up and we open our eyes in the morning, we are making thousands of decisions, like what to eat, what to wear, what to do, and
so on. I know, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And decision-making actually is...
Sometimes it kind of becomes hard, like what to decide.
Yeah, it is really hard, even about the tiniest things. Like
especially when there are many choices.
Exactly. And, you know, as a youth, I think we have so many big choices that we have to make, like the marriage, like study, education, job, and so many other things. So the question here is, what is the biggest decision that we make?
Like, for example, just as you mentioned, different things like marriage and studies and all. So I guess like all these things do not come at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So I feel each and every situation has got the best and the big decision for its own time.
Yeah, I get it.
Like, for example, you know, I'm studying, I finished my school. Now my biggest decision is like choosing the right college.
Yeah.
Like, what subject should I choose?
Yeah, so you mean that in every specific time, there is the specific biggest decision that we are
making. Accordingly, yeah.
Yeah. And, but you know, there is one little thing, one thing that, for example, for the whole of your life is the most important one. Do you think, is there even any thing like that or not?
Out of all these decisions, like, the most important one, like, what's the goal of my life? What am I going to do in future? Like, what's my purpose?
Yeah.
So this, I guess, and this decision, like under this decision, like what you're going to do or what's the goal of your life, with the answer of this decision, like you shape your life.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is one of the most important questions that we ask from ourselves.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So welcome back, dear listeners. We're here again next to you and talking about the biggest decision.
Yeah, and I was asking the sister about the biggest decision of youth.
You know, I think the biggest decision actually is related to the future, the thing that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a big part of everybody's life is thinking about the future of that person, of the goal, of the relationship that I'm making in my life, and according to my afterlife, what am I doing, okay? And one of the things that I was dealing with as one of the decisions, maybe, or one of the challenges of my life was the connection that I have with Allah Almighty. It was so perplexing and challenging for me, you know, because first of all, I needed a kind of clear picture of myself and my potential capacities and so many other things. And then I had to know my Lord. Okay. And this challenge was one of the decisions that I had to make in order to do it. I have, for example, so many difficult decisions, like what major should I study in the university, and whether I go to university or work, or these kind of questions. You know, the problem is the choices are so variable. And when you have a lot of choices, then decision-making is a really difficult task.
Okay, if I, sister, if I ask you this way, like, while making a decision, should it be our, like, whole and soul, it should be our decision, or, like, we should ask someone, like, who is experienced, like, what should we select, or what should we opt for?
What do you think about this? Consulting other people is really important, you know, because you can use their experiences. For example, think of someone who is like 50 or 60 years old. For sure, she or he has so many experiences that I don't have. But, you know, I think the youth generation of the modern time are so rebel and, you know, they feel like they have to do something in order to experience it. You cannot listen it from other people and just make it practically in your own life. You have to do it yourself. Yeah. And if for a short time, it was like that. I felt like I have to do anything myself. And it has its own consequences. It takes a lot of time. It has so many harms and so other things. So I came to this end point that I have to consult other people. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that I am weak or I cannot
because
do
they have gone through the things that we are starting the path of which. Yeah.
Yeah. And how about you? Whenever coming to these situations in life that you have to make a big decision, what is your strategy?
What I think is I have elder brothers, right? So I'm the youngest of my family. So, you know, before doing anything, like either I ask my brothers or I ask someone like who has done this thing before.
Yeah.
Like especially like for choosing a major in my college, in my university. You know, what subject and what can I get from this? I don't know, right? You know, I'm starting to just, you know, take the first step in my life.
Exactly.
Like in this field. So I just prefer consulting someone who has already experienced it.
It's a nice choice because, you know, someone told me, do you like your profession? I mean, I'm studying medicine and he asked me, do you like medical things and so on? I told him that I didn't went through that, okay? Mm-hmm. I didn't go through this and I have no knowledge what it would be like to actually study medicine. And because of that, I ask other people whether they like it or not. And the answer is my answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think this is something natural for every one of us because we live only once in this world and we have limited time.
Sister, one more thing, which is concerning over here is like what people do, like whatever people work. It's not every time that, you know, necessarily that they have decided to do this. Or they have chosen to do this.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like, you know, it's their decisions were something else, but they were forced to do this.
I know. I know there are so many difficult situations that you are in a kind of environmental phase that other things will actually affect your choices. For example, I don't know an example right now, but I feel the question. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is nothing we can do in this kind of situations, but to try to take control over the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which is not something easy. You have to understand that, okay, if you were born in a poor family, it wasn't your fault, it wasn't your decision. But that, you know, famous sentence that if you die poor, then it is your decision.
Yeah, it's your problem. Yeah, it's your decision. You could have worked hard and you would have overcome the other decisions, you know, other people forcing upon you.
Yeah.
And sometimes it happens, look, I want to do something. And this is, you know, this leads to the youth. This leads to people thinking that I don't have any rights. I don't have anything to choose on myself. Like, for example, I guess there's some countries and there's a culture that the young or youth are supposed to do whatever their elders say.
Yeah.
So this makes them feel like we don't have any choice. We don't have any freedom.
It's not like that. And even
this happens in some places.
Yeah, I know. Even in my country, you know, it's like every child should actually study like medicine or engineering and you can do nothing about it. This is the atmosphere that exists in the society. So let's keep our conversation here. We're going to go for a short break and we're going to come back in a heartbeat.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And before the break, we were discussing people being forced into different occupations or different situations, like where they feel that they have not chosen this for themselves, but they're being forced to. So I guess over here, sometimes what happens is, you know, in some places, as I mentioned, like in some cultures, you know, I'm not supposed to do whatever I feel like doing. You know, I'm not supposed to, like, you know, if I like science, but I'm supposed to do whatever my parents say, whatever my elders say. You know, it happens in some countries.
Yeah.
You're forced into some field, although you don't want to do it. This has become a custom in some places, but not necessarily everywhere. It's got the bad side. Some places, you know, the elders choose for the young ones whatever is best for them.
Yeah.
And many times it happens that, you know, the young or the youth are not aware of the benefits of their decisions.
I know, exactly. This is the thing that happened to me, myself, as to some extent I was forced to my field, but after studying it, after going through the university and so on, I just get to know that it's something beneficial for me. It was the best choice in this situation. And because of that, I think to some extent, you have to fight for your own decisions, but sometimes you can let it go. And you can trust elders of your family, of your society, and so on. And it doesn't mean that you are, being somehow ignorant or something to your life. No, it is the best choice itself to keep quiet sometimes.
Sometimes we are not aware of, what the elders are aware of. But many times it happens, it's literally force. So, many people actually ask this as well.
Yeah.
My parents are not letting me do this. I want to do this.
You feel like everybody wants you to do something. Everybody is oppressing you. Everybody is sacrificing you for their own will. But it's not like that. Sometimes people are trying to help you. And you have to think under suggestion before actually acting, before fighting with them, or before doing anything aggressively. Just keep it calm and think. So, how about you, my dear brother? Do you have any suggestion for parents or youth?
First of all, I feel like, the parents shouldn't be, dictators in, upbringing their children. Like, they shouldn't force whatever they think. Of course, after reaching to a point that, there's no better option than what they have suggested, then that's a different thing.
Yeah.
Because many times, as we mentioned, children are not aware of the outcome. So they should also look into the need or the requirement or the choice of their children. So here, when this happens that, you want something and your parents want something opposite, what you can do is, first of all, if you whatever you want, if it's actually good, if it's actually good, you can sit and talk to your parents. You can talk to your parents and you can tell them the benefits of it. You can tell them, I like this. These are the reasons. You can get reasoning.
Yeah, the best method, I think.
Okay, yeah, and you can get the reasoning and you can get someone else, some other elder and, have them to talk with them.
Yeah, this one will work too.
Yeah, if you go, in a proper way and, in the beginning, if you start, arguing with your parents, I don't want to do this.
Shouting,
this is what I have decided. If you opt this way, then of course it's going to make the things worse.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
So if you go the smooth way, you explain to them, why have you chosen this? You like this, and what are the reasons, and why is it good for you? And you get someone else, some other elder as well, so to have them explain to them. So then there are chances that, they agree to you as well.
There are times in everybody's life that we face difficult choices that we have to decide among them. And there are times that even you don't have any choice to decide and your decision is somehow forced on you. So in both, I think, categories of situations, you have to keep calm, you have to think and consider all the opportunities, benefits, pros and cons of all the things that are happening and then decide the best way for your life. So I think it was all the time we had for today's episode. Thank you for listening to us.
That's it for today. And with that being said, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. Be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.